I'm Abigail.
And I'm Keith.
And this is the Global Treasures Podcast. We'll cover different World Heritage sites each episode.
These sites have been identified as having outstanding universal value
because they have cultural and/or natural significance that's so exceptional that it transcends national boundaries and is of importance to present and future generations.
There are 1,199 sites across the world, with more being added each year.
We'll explore the legends, history, travel tips, and so much more.
Welcome to Season 2, where we will explore the 45 sites that UNESCO added in 1979.
In this episode, Keith and I will be introducing you to the archaeological site of Carthage, located in Tunisia.
This North African city was the capital of one of the most powerful empires of the ancient world, and was in direct competition with Rome as the most dominant around the Mediterranean. The three wars that Carthage fought with Rome are the stuff of legends and lasted 100 years. The rivalry was so great that it famously caused Cicero, the Roman senator, to repeatedly exclaim, "Delendas Carthago," or "Carthage must be destroyed." The city was featured prominently in Greek mythology as the home of the legendary Dido, who is also known as Elissa. She's the legendary founder and first queen of the city. The original queen of the Phoenician city-state of Tyre, located in modern Lebanon, she fled tyranny and founded her own city in northwest Africa. Since we only know of Dido through Greek and Roman sources, all of which were written well after the founding of the city, the historical accuracy of this legend is uncertain, but it is still wonderful to explore. The details are best known from the account given in Virgil's epic poem, The Aeneid, written about 20 BC, which accounts the legendary story of the Trojan hero Aeneas. Dido is painted as a clever and enterprising woman who is Aeneas' lover, who runs away from her evil brother Pygmalion after finding out that he had her husband killed. Under Dido's leadership, the city of Carthage is founded and quickly becomes prosperous.
Dido remains a figure that has endured. She inspired countless poems, operas, and classical oil paintings, and as a result, her legend continues on. In the 20th century, she was chosen as a national symbol in Tunisia, so that Tunisian women can be referred to as daughters of Dido. She was even featured on Tunisian currency in 2006. So the name Carthage means new city or new town, and the city was declared a UNESCO site in 1979. It became the most powerful trading and commercial city in the Mediterranean from 650 BC until its destruction in 146 BC. By about 200 BC, the city was the original Mediterranean superpower, with vast control over trading ports and various North African trade routes. At its height, Carthage controlled much of North Africa, Sardinia, Corsica, Sicily, and the Iberian Peninsula. The city also became the second largest in the ancient Mediterranean, only behind Alexandria, the capital of Ptolemaic Egypt.
A visit to this archaeological area reveals some spectacular main sites. There's so much to see and study here that there are still ruins that haven't been studied, and no one knows what they are yet. Driving through the area on the main roads, you'll pass columns reaching up to the sky and stone structures that have not even been fully unearthed. Carthage is currently seeing a revitalization of archaeological efforts by the Tunisia Ministry of Culture and the European Union that is aiming to restore several of the numerous sites of the ancient city. This effort is also aiming to renovate the Carthage National Museum, and the museum is expected to reopen in June of 2026. So if you're listening to this episode after that time, make sure to make the museum part of your travel plans. It is rumored that it is going to be outstanding. A 20-minute drive away from the present-day city of Tunis, from the peak of Bursa Hill, which overlooks the Punic port that was responsible for growing the city's power, you can explore the ancient Acropolis, which is the upper fortified height of the ancient city, the aforementioned museum, and also several wonderfully maintained Carthaginian houses.
Starting from this complex on the top of the hill, you can descend into the ancient city to explore the crescent-shaped port that was home to the famous Carthaginian fleet. While today it's only used by fishing boats, it was the nucleus of the most powerful navy in the ancient world. A small walking path runs around the rim, where you can try to visualize how awe-inspiring it must have been for our ancestors.
Down the street is the Tophet of Salambo, which is thought to be an ancient graveyard and could have even been the burial ground for animals and children that were used in ritual sacrifices. While the sacrifice rumor may be true, it's more likely that this was a rumor spread by Greek and Roman rivals. Roughly 20,000 urns buried under stone slabs have been found here, marking it as one of the largest cemeteries from the Phoenician period.
Also in the city, Odeon Hill is an archaeological site that holds numerous ruins, including the theater, the Odeon, and the park of the Roman villas. And I realize we should explain. An Odeon is the name for ancient Greek and Roman buildings built for activities such as singing, shows, and poetry competitions. So, the park includes the Villa of the Aviary, the best-preserved Roman villa within the site of Carthage. Another, the House of Horses, contains a mosaic of more than 50 circus horses bordered by hunting scenes. While most of the rest of the Roman villas are not in the best shape, you can see that the neighborhood had orthogonal streets with successive tiers of houses and streets built into the side of the hill.
In size, the Theater of Carthage is the second largest Roman theater in Africa behind the one in Utica. The theater is the stuff of legends and can even be explored today. It extends over an area equivalent to 4 city blocks and is probably from the time of Augustus Caesar. The author Tertullian, who was a prolific early Christian author from Carthage, mentions the famous theater in his writing, describing the richness of decoration, the splendor of the marble, their parquet floor, and the beautiful pillars. You can actually watch archaeologists restore structures here and refurbish mosaics.
The city also boasts what's considered to be the largest Roman Odeon as well. Adjacent to the theater and taking up a space of 3 city blocks, it has a seating capacity of up to 20,000 spectators.
Down by the ocean and adjacent to Tunisia's presidential palace, the Baths of Antoninus are the largest set of Roman baths built on the African continent, and actually one of the 3 largest built by the entire Roman Empire. Built during the reign of Emperor Antoninus Pius, they're considered to be one of the most important landmarks in all of Tunisia. Used for centuries, they were still active well into the Arab period of the city. Remarkably well-preserved walls, tunnels, and porticos make up this archaeological site. The source of the water for these baths is one of the longest Roman aqueducts, the 82-mile-long Saguan Aqueduct. This feat of ancient engineering brought water from a nearby mountain range all the way to the cisterns of La Malga. These are the largest cisterns surviving from the ancient world and held roughly 14 million gallons of water.
The Circus of Carthage hasn't been well researched, but was Rome's second largest circus, one that rivaled the Circus Maximus. Built on top of a former necropolis sometime around 238 AD, it remained in use for centuries. Measuring 1,550 feet long by 100 feet wide, there was seating for 45,000 spectators who could watch the exciting, and sometimes deadly, chariot races. The best description of the circus is based on a mosaic found in the Bardo National Museum in Tunis, which I'll talk about later. It's the only mosaic to show both the interior and exterior facade.
The city was a fantastic melting pot of cultures due to the centralized trade. Greeks, Phoenicians, Italians, Iberians, Nubians, and Libyans from North Africa all met, traded goods, traded ideas, religion, and culture, and as a result, created a city that was truly unique in the ancient world. Carthage boasted a sophisticated dock harbor that had as many as 200 docks. This, along with an extremely wealthy population, supported a sprawling metropolis of temples, markets, and estates within the city. From roughly 650 BC to 146 BC, Carthage grew from a small colony to the capital of a sprawling empire. As this colony grew in size and power during the 7th century BC, it began to assert its independence from its nearby mother city, Tyre, which is actually one of the oldest continually inhabited cities in the world. Even as the independence of the city grew, Carthage continued to show allegiance by sending an annual embassy to Tyre's temple of Melkart, which was Tyre's patron deity at the time.
After Tyre was conquered by the Babylonians in the early 6th century, the Phoenician colonies in the western Mediterranean turned to the increasingly powerful Carthage for protection and support against the Greeks. Other ancient Phoenician colonies, such as Utica and Gades in Hispania, which is also known as modern-day Spain, became bound to Carthage by treaties, thus expanding Carthage's reach.
A note to remember throughout this episode. We'll both often use the word Punic to describe Carthage and the events surrounding this ancient city. Punic is often used as a synonym for Carthaginian, so don't be thrown off. When I first learned about ancient Carthage and studied it, it seemed like the authors were describing something else, but Carthage and Carthaginian events, people, and culture are often referred to as Punic. So even though Carthage had extensive contact with Greeks and Libyans, the Carthaginians retained the Punic language, which was a dialect related to Hebrew. This language would long outlast the Carthaginian Empire, all the way into the 5th century AD, with some linguistic historians claiming that it may have even lasted as long as the 9th century.
As the city became more and more powerful through its unrivaled navy, it started to become clear that they treated their allies very differently than Rome did. Roman allies at the time participated in mutual defensive organizations under the direct leadership of Rome and gradually integrated the people into Roman society, granting rights and even citizenship. Carthage approached the arrangement much differently. Carthage preferred to extract taxes from its loose confederation of subjects and the subjects' allies. These taxes were used to finance Carthage's powerful navy and to buy mercenary soldiers. We both think that it's important to understand the history of this city in order to also understand how important the archaeological site is and why UNESCO chose it for listing under the World Heritage Sites. So let's cover some of the main events of the Punic Empire.
As mentioned before, 814 BC is the traditional founding date for the city, although, as we mentioned, Queen Dido is said to have founded the city in 825. Over the next 300 years, the city grew in power and in importance due to the focus placed on trade and, consequently, the navy that protected that trade. This growth led Carthage to eventually fight Greece for dominance in Sicily, which is one of the regions of modern-day Italy. From 580 BC to 306 BC, Carthage fought battle after battle against other cultures and nations to expand its reach. Some of these battles are famous enough to be studied today, such as the Battle of Alagia off the coast of Corsica and the Battle of Himera. The naval and military action during this time led to the first treaty between Rome and Carthage, the expansion of the Carthaginian Empire into the Iberian Peninsula, the control of Sicily by Carthage, and the further expansion of Carthage deeper into North Africa.
In 264 BC, the Mamertines, who were a small mercenary band of Italian origin, held the city of Messina in Italy, where they used it as a raiding base. When their city was besieged by a nearby city of Syracuse in 265 BC, they called for help from a nearby Carthaginian navy. After several escalations where allies were increasingly called, Carthage and Rome were brought into direct conflict. This war was fought between the two superpowers for over 22 years and was known as the First Punic War.
During this war, the two ancient superpowers fought to establish control over the very important strategic islands of Corsica and Sicily. This war resulted in Carthage ceding Sicily and the Lipari Islands, but also forced Carthage to pay reparations to Rome. During this time, one of the most famous Carthaginians was born to Hamilcar Barca, one of the Carthaginian generals, in 247 BC. This child's name was Hannibal, who would be one of the most powerful enemies of the Roman Empire and would eventually single-handedly spark the Second Punic War.
As Carthage was further expanding into modern-day Spain in 237 BC, an agreement was made between Rome and Carthage not to cross the Ebro River. Ignoring this, a young Hannibal takes control of Carthage's armies in Spain and crosses the Ebro to sack the city of Saguntum, a Roman ally, and this sparks the Second Punic War. In 218 BC, Hannibal left Spain in his famous trek to cross the Pyrenees and Alps to avoid the Roman navy with 30,000 troops, 15,000 horses, and 37 war elephants. Taking only 16 days to cross the mountains, he launched an attack on Rome from the north.
Winning three battles in succession, Hannibal advanced on Rome itself, but couldn't take the city due to lack of supplies and reinforcements. In 216, Hannibal wins the incredibly famous Battle of Cannae, which becomes the worst defeat in Roman Empire's history. The war continues to be fought by two empires throughout northern Africa, the Iberian Peninsula, the Mediterranean islands, and even in Italy. By 205 BC, the Carthaginians were driven out of the Iberian Peninsula, and the famous Roman general Scipio Africanus sailed to North Africa with his armies. This leads to Carthage recalling Hannibal from Italy to defend the city against Scipio. Scipio defeated Hannibal at the Battle of Zama and ended the Second Punic War, in which Carthage was defeated for a second time by Rome. Hannibal then flees to Hadrumetum, and a peace treaty is signed by both empires.
In 195 BC, Hannibal was in danger of being handed over to the Romans, so he fled further to the Seleucid court of Antiochus III and became his advisor. In 183 BC, Titus Quintus Faminus, forgive my pronunciation, the Roman general who defeated Macedon, demanded that Hannibal should be surrendered to the Roman hands. King Prusias gives in to these demands, causing the great Hannibal to commit suicide in the village of Libissa in order to escape captivity.
45 years later, a Carthaginian army attacks Numidia, breaking the Second Punic War peace treaty, which sparks a Third Punic War between Rome and Carthage. A year after, Rome sends an army of 80,000 infantry and 40,000 cavalry to attack and siege Carthage. For 2 years, the city holds out in this siege until Scipio Africanus the Younger takes control of the siege and orders the construction of a mole, which is kind of a massive wall, across the Carthage harbor, thus blocking aid by the Punic navy. The siege is eventually successful, and in 146 BC, the city of Carthage is utterly destroyed, and its lands become the new Roman province of Africa. Scipio Africanus the Younger completely enslaves its entire population, and Carthage effectively ceases to be an empire for the rest of history.
Between the years of 49 and 44 BC, Julius Caesar would establish Carthage as a Roman colony, and his successor, Augustus Caesar, would continue to support its development. After a few decades, Carthage would become one of Rome's most important colonies. By the first century AD, it had grown to become the second largest city in the western half of the Roman Empire, with a peak population of 500,000. The city continued to grow in importance for the Roman Empire and eventually became the capital of the Roman province of Africa, which was a major breadbasket for the entire empire. The wealth that flowed through the city caused major construction, including the famous amphitheater.
In 397, Carthage became the center of early Christianity, and the city developed the Bursa Hill area with luxurious dwellings, including the Villa de Volier, which is the Villa of the Aviary. A circular monument called Rotunda Serpodium Carae was excavated nearby during a UNESCO campaign, and this monument can be visited today.
In 439, the city was conquered by the Vandals and thus served as the capital of the Vandal Kingdom for more than a century. It was reconquered by the Eastern Roman Empire in 534 and went back to serving as an important Eastern Roman regional center. For the next 165 years, the city was the capital of Byzantine North Africa.
In 698, the city was sacked and destroyed once again in a scorched earth policy by the Umayyad Arab forces. This was to prevent it from being reconquered and used as a fortress by the Byzantine Empire. The city walls were torn down, the water supply cut off, agricultural lands were ravaged, and the harbors were made unusable. This marked the permanent end to Roman rule in the region. There is evidence, however, that people continued to live in the city, and even that the Roman baths were still functioning and in good shape.
Throughout the 700s, Carthage was used as a source of building materials for nearby Kairouan and Tunis. The city was garrisoned by Muslim forces until it was captured by Crusaders during the Eighth Crusade in 1270. After the withdrawal of Crusaders, the Hafsids decided to destroy the remaining fortress at Carthage to prevent any future use by a foreign power.
The ruins of Carthage were rediscovered at the end of the 19th century, and Odeon Hill was excavated from 1900 to 1901, with the amphitheater then being excavated in 1904. Excavations and archaeology has continued to this day on this incredibly important ancient site. So as one of the most important ancient sites around the Mediterranean, I'm sure that Carthage is on the must-see list for many travelers. Let's talk about how to get there and some tips and tricks while visiting. And of course, let's talk about the food. So Abigail, what did you find out?
Sure, so let's get you there. If you're flying into Tunisia from another country, you'll want to fly into the Tunis-Carthage airport and take the metro line, a bus, or taxi to Carthage, which should only take you about 15 minutes or so. They're very close together. Once you get to the archaeological site, you can purchase a ticket that will get you into all of the sites. Or you can try to find information on buying a ticket in advance online through the official government website to avoid waiting in long lines. Tickets are inexpensive, but you could consider booking a tour or getting a personal guide who speaks your native language and knows the history, because there are no informational plaques or signs at the sites, and the primary language is Arabic, so you might otherwise find yourself staring at buildings or monuments, not actually knowing the context or what you're looking at. Also, the different sites are spread out, so expect to do a lot of walking. And if you have a disability, this isn't a site where you're necessarily going to be accommodated if you have physical needs.
All right, that's good stuff. So what seems like the best time of year to visit?
Per usual, I encourage you to use the weather as your guide. That often helps Keith and I. While it's in the mid-50s Fahrenheit in January, which is comfortable, it can get up to the mid-80s in summer, which are hot and dry. The winters seem to be more mild and rainy. However, I should note that this is a site that gets a lot of visitors, so that might change your tune in terms of when you want to go, because you may encounter crowds. Carthage gets 242,500 visitors annually.
So obviously, Carthage is probably the destination for many visitors. Do people seem to just visit the archaeological site of Carthage, or do they do other things while in the area?
I mean, the site is large, so it's not like you'll be in and out in an hour. However, some sites you can couple include the Bardo Museum, which is in Tunis, and houses Islamic art, among other treasures. People often visit the Medina of Tunis as well in the same trip, which is also a UNESCO site. In terms of where you can stay, there are a lot of nice hotels to budget-friendly hostels. Also, some things to note, this country has some of the most interesting laws I've noted so far in my research. Example number one, it's illegal to take photos of embassies, governmental, and military sites or buildings. So don't just aimlessly take photos of pretty buildings or you might find yourself in hot water. Also, if you're like me and you seek out antiques, make sure you obtain permission or any necessary permit before trying to take it home. I guess they have a lot of issues with antiquities trafficking, which is the illegal selling of culturally important items. So this is like selling stolen artifacts from tombs, etc. You likely won't even know that's what you're purchasing, so just be smart. If the price is too good to be true, that might be a red flag.
Yikes, that kind of thing bothers me. These antiquities belong in museums, or even better, at the original site in which they were found. Okay. Everyone knows that I travel first for the culture, but then second for the food. What can we look forward to for cuisine in the area?
I was getting to that. So the food tends to be spicy.
Ooh, I dig spicy.
I know you do. An example of a popular condiment or marinade slash sauce, if you will, is harissa, which is a mix of garlic, chili peppers, and other spices that's frequently used in dishes. Couscous is a staple as well. And this is boiled durum wheat, which is on UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage. It's frequently served at gatherings from holidays to funerals. Meats like lamb or whole fish with the head and tail included, with French fries, are popular too.
Okay, that stuff sounds wonderful, and as usual, I'm sure we could put an entire episode together about the food in this region. All right, what about other legends besides the all-important legend of Queen Dido? Did you find any other?
Two legends. So the first is around jinns. There's a story frequently told to children by their parents when they're being naughty and loud. According to legend, whistling at night will summon jinns, which are spirits, who supposedly are real creatures that are kind of residing in a world outside of ours, but have the ability to harm humans. I guess they bring bad juju. It kind of reminds me of the story of La Llorona. Something to scare children into behaving. So don't make your parents whistle, kids. The second is super interesting. There are legends floating around about hidden treasure. There are writings that go as far back as 68 AD, claiming there are valuables and gold coins underneath Tunis and Carthage. It's believed that shortly before the city was destroyed, the Carthaginians took all of their worldly possessions and buried them in a tunnel under the city. This sounds plausible to me and has been done throughout history.
Wow, so that's a legend worth listening to. I mean, the Carthaginians knew that the city was about to be taken, so I'm guessing they would have ample reason to do such a thing. Any leads on this yet?
I mean, in terms of proof, when the harbor of Tunis was being built, engineers found traces of a tunnel, but no treasure. However, they didn't go very deep because I'm guessing it wasn't very safe to. Maybe there will be a gold hunting or prospecting show about this in the future. Very intriguing. All right, now I want to transition to talk about some of the issues that this site faces in terms of preservation and keeping its UNESCO World Heritage status. Carthage has been at risk of being taken off the list over the years for a couple of reasons. The first being due to being located on the coast. The rising sea levels and coastal erosion leave the site in danger of damage from future flooding. There has been talk of adding seawalls to protect the ruins, but I don't see that there's been any movement on actually getting that construction started. Also, there was major controversy when the government knocked down homes overnight without alerting residents, because some homes and buildings were constructed without permission, on land that specialists deemed to have historical importance. The government has been battling in court with locals who are claiming discrimination. I just can't imagine coming home one day to find my house wasn't there. That's a tough situation. I hope that they're able to find a happy medium between keeping foot traffic to a minimum to protect the site, while also respecting local residents so we can all continue to enjoy this incredible place. Thank you for listening to the Global Treasures Podcast. If you would like to support the show, you can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also check us out on YouTube and TikTok.
Also, tell your friends about us. If you know people who love history and love to travel, share this podcast with them so that they can learn some new history or maybe even get some ideas for their next trip.
Join us next time when we travel to Poland to learn the dark history of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi concentration and extermination camp.